Monster Man, special episode, Monsters Under the Bed. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon supporters, and in particular, of Patreon supporter Jesse. If you'd like to be like Jesse and get your own special episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And when you do that, in addition to getting to choose a topic for a special episode, you'll also get other rewards, such as all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is currently beginning a series about Hawaiian mythology. So Jesse, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy today's episode. Jesse has asked me to talk about the monster under the bed, that staple of childhood fears, of the literature of childhood, of cartoons and artistic depictions of childhood, something that turns up in Monsters, Inc. and Calvin and Hobbes and, you know, almost anything that talks about childhood will eventually talk about the monster under the bed. And that makes sense because the monster under the bed is sort of the archetypal childish fear. The idea that there's something terrifying under your bed, and perhaps we can expand this to include something that is in your closet. The partly open closet door is another source of childhood monsters. What does it come from? Is it a childish fear of separation? Is it something that appears, you know, when children first begin to sleep in their own rooms? I don't know. I don't recall that I ever really had a monster under the bed phase, and I wonder if that is because when I was of like the right age to have monsters under the bed, I shared a room with my brother, and I didn't have my own bedroom until a little bit later on, and that perhaps, you know, was too late for me to believe in a monster under the bed. So maybe it's that fear of loneliness or separation, that sense of vulnerability. Maybe it's like the uncomfortable realization that spaces that you can't see continue to exist. Or maybe it's just pareidolia, that the human impulse to read shapes and patterns in other objects, turning, you know, shirts hanging in the closet into people or gurgling plumbing into monstrous growls. Although the monster under the bed is an absolutely characteristic childhood fear, it's not the only childhood monster. And I think it does need to be distinguished from the boogeyman, properly so-called. A boogeyman, my American listeners would say. Etymologically related to monsters like the bugbear, or the puka, or the boggart, or indeed the bug. The boogeyman, I think of anyway, as a monster that is used to discipline children. If you don't eat your vegetables, the boogeyman will come and get you, or the bogeyman, depending. I tend to, like, know that bogeyman is the quote-unquote correct way for me to say it, living as I do in the UK, but I revert to boogeyman most of the time because that's kind of like my dialect. The difference is that the boogeyman is imposed on children. Children resist the boogeyman, but the boogeyman is like backed up by adults. By contrast, the monster under the bed, and kind of maybe unusually in a domestic setting, the monster under the bed is something that children attempt to impose on adults. You want your parents to come in and see whether there's a monster under your bed. Your parents want you to go back to sleep, and they tell you there's no such thing as monsters. So this one, rather than being promoted by authority and resisted by the child, like the boogeyman, is promoted by the child and resisted by authority. Now that is maybe a more common, like, horror movie, horror story structure, where the vulnerable person is the point of view character, and they're attempting to persuade the world around them that a monster exists, but the world around them won't listen. The authorities won't acknowledge the horror that's going on. That's a very typical horror structure, but there's a problem with it when we try to transfer it into a fantasy setting. Well, I'm gonna put a big asterisk next to that, because like a lot of genre collision problems, it's not as bad as it seems because fantasy games are fine with a certain level of genre collision typically. But in principle, there's a genre collision here because the bed monster or closet monster presupposes a world in which the existence of monsters is not generally accepted. You know, even in a D&D setting, like if you're in a D&D world and you tell your parents that there's a monster under your bed. Well, they might not believe you, but they still might check. The idea that a goblin might have somehow got into the house and be under your bed waiting to, like, break out and cause chaos and start fires and things, it's no more ridiculous than, like, hearing something moving and thinking it's an intruder and going down to look and it's only your cat. The vast majority of times, the thing you hear moving around downstairs in a cat owner's home is the cat, but burglars are real, and people do check for them. So if we're in a fantasy world where the presence of monsters is understood, and indeed where monsters are comparatively ubiquitous, and that seems to be like the contemporary D&D setting in general. Now, this is a little bit less so in earlier editions. So in the editions that this show mostly focuses on, we tend to have fantasy worlds that are divided into a more or less mundane, quasi-historical, inward safe place, and a fantastical outward other. So adventurers spend their, like, time between adventures in cities, which are full, okay, like, have elves and dwarves and halflings and gnomes and things, but those have been adopted into the safe place. But they typically don't have cockatrices and ochre jellies and whatever. Maybe in those parts of the urban landscape that we can think of as a fantastical other, your sewers and your dungeons and your wizards' labs and zoos and things, but typically in the main street, it's just people selling turnips out of carts. That's not true in your sort of typical fifth edition game, where immersion in the fantastical is part of the, like, wish fulfillment aspect of the game. It's not even so much, I mean, obviously there is the thing of wanting to be a hero who overcomes fantastical monsters, but there's also the wish fulfillment of being a person in a fantastical world, just kind of being like a little fantasy tourist and being in a, you know, the big city that's full of merfolk and flying carpets and so forth, which was less common in early versions of the game. Anyway, either way, you'd think that this would be a world in which the monster under the bed wouldn't necessarily work. And I don't think it works as written, but I do think that it can be successful because ultimately the target audience for anything that you're putting into your game, the people who are being required to appreciate the thing, are the players. We've talked about this before when we talked about, for example, vampires. Why are vampires, or other undead monsters, but vampires, like, in particular, considered to be more frightening? You know, there are lots of antagonists. I mean, dragons would be the most obvious example. Dragons are considered to be a threat, and in that sense, they are portrayed as dangerous and frightening, but they're not given the trappings of horror like a vampire is. And that's because monsters from other genres bring with them some of those genre trappings, even when within a fantasy, it shouldn't logically make sense. But fantasy is not about logically making sense. So as long as the players have those associations for the monster under the bed, then it can work in a game, even though it doesn't make an enormous amount of sense that the characters should have those associations. I do think that you have to subvert it a little bit, so it's hard to play this monster straight. You could, for instance, reverse the roles. So imagine that you are exploring a giant's castle by night, hearing approaching footsteps, you scuttle into a nearby room, you take cover underneath a bed, and then you hear the massive timbers of the bed creaking and groaning over your head, and an enormous voice goes, you know, this deep booming giant voice, but it's still a little kid that's like, mommy, mommy, there are humans under my bed. And then the giant's mother comes in and in an equally deep and booming giant voice says, you know, oh, go to bed, silly, there's no such things as monsters, you know, won't you check? And then while all this is happening, you're like throwing your grappling hooks up into the slats of the bed so that you can shimmy up there in case mom actually bends down to take a look. You could reverse the threat, right? So instead of having the creature under the bed be harmful, you could actually have it be helpful, right? So this obviously, like, this fits in with your various brownies and Kilmulises and even, like, gremlins and things. These are creatures that could be under your bed. This kind of maybe moves it outside of the realm of a creature under the bed and more into the realm of an imaginary friend. But whatever, the point is that the adults in the situation may perceive the monster as being harmful and try to do something about it. Oh, there's something under little Timmy's bed? Well, it must be a monster. You know, let's stay up with our crossbows. But in fact, it's something that could be helpful. So you sort of wind up having to try and protect the under-the-bed creature. You could set it in a local environment where there are very specifically known to be no monsters. So maybe a blessing from some god keeps this city safe. Like there's basically a big bubble around it. You know, maybe some warding effect cast by a wizard keeps this neighborhood full of rich people free from monsters, while like all the poor people down in the slums are, you know, fighting off ghouls and what have you. Something like that. And then you could have the situation where the little child's belief that there is a monster under their bed is indicative that this is breaking down, but this privileged people that don't have to deal with monsters, well, they are so like arrogant and overconfident that they think, oh, well, it's just little Sally's fantasies. And then you, as the people who like have spent time outside the both literal and figurative bubble, you kind of have to be the ones to take the kids seriously and sort of investigate, but maybe like at the same time, not attracting ridicule from all of these poshos because you're doing that, right? So again, that could be fun. So I think you can use the monster under the bed in a more conventional fantasy game, as long as you put a little bit of a twist on it. You have to slightly turn it away from what players expect. Having said that, I don't know that there is a sort of stock expectation of the monster under the bed. It's more of an image than it is a story. So that's another advantage that it has, that it doesn't come with like a beginning, middle, and an end, other than maybe the beginning, middle, and end being like, child cries for parent, parent comes in, parent assures child there is no monster, parent goes back to bed. Now, once we move outside the context of a generic fantasy world where monsters are ubiquitous and into a like modern or historical or even science fictional setting, then we get the monster under the bed in its kind of full form, right? Then it's a classic. I would look at specific instances of kids believing in monsters under the bed rather than just kind of going with the generic there's a monster under my bed. Because I think when you look at what children actually say and do about this, they have this kind of specificity that's hard to fake. So, for instance, I said that I never believed in a monster under my bed when I was a kid, or at least I don't remember doing so. But my wife has told me that when she was a child, she believed specifically that the devil was underneath her bed with a knife. And that kind of like the individuality of that belief, the details that you wouldn't create, even the kind of slight sense of incongruity are all really nice. The devil waiting under a kid's bed with a knife is exactly the kind of like personalized view of evil that kids have, indeed that people generally have, but it also has this sense of like mismatch. There was these old, I think it was a series of Saturday Night Live sketches where John Lovitz played the devil. And there was one where he was on like the People's Court, which was a TV, like Judge Judy, but basically before that. And this, his neighbor is suing him for like raking leaves into her yard or something like that. And at one point she talks about like upending trash bags in her yard. And she says, why do you keep harassing me? And he goes, harassing you? I am Mephistopheles, the Prince of Darkness. When I start harassing you, you'll know it. You know, and like, I feel like if Satan, who is the devil, was going to terrorize you, he probably have better ways to do it than like hanging out with a knife. But kids don't think like that. So on the one hand, that's an extremely silly image. But on the other hand, it has this specificity that gives it a visceral horror. The idea of getting out of bed, putting your feet on the floor, and you know exactly that there's this vulnerable spot where if someone was under your bed with a knife, they could just slash at your ankles. That's really frightening. I can absolutely imagine getting that idea into my head as a kid and sort of like springing off my bed on my hands so that I would land far enough away from the edge that the devil couldn't get at me with the knife. The idea of someone like reaching out from underneath something to grab your ankles and trip you is also really upsetting. So I think if you talk to the child in your life that believes in monsters under the bed, or that remember the specific fears that you had when you were a kid, then you'll come up with more interesting under the bed monsters than just the generic kind of Calvin and Hobbes. It is Calvin and Hobbes. He has like conversations. Calvin has conversations with his under the bed monster. I think that's right. It's been a long time. Anyway, if we have creatures under beds or in closets, that raises the question of where the monsters are coming from, right? If we hear a scream and we run into the bedroom, you know, with flashlights and fireplace pokers to see little Jaden being dragged under the bed, where do we imagine that little Jaden is going? I want to say, you know, I posted on social media earlier trying to remember where this, I think what I'm thinking of is something called the Cardboard Palace from the role-playing game Unknown Armies. There are lots of other examples of this, which are sort of like other spaces, other worlds, other dimensions that are made of all the like abandoned spaces, all the bricked off rooms and abandoned subway stations and, you know, whatever, all the places that are not used, but that would be accessible or would otherwise have been accessible in the world. And I like that idea for another dimension. There obviously are kind of like other related. I believe a lot of people have told me that's kind of how there are monsters that work like that in the show Hilda, sort of also kind of connected to Neverwhere, right, where there's the abandoned parts of the underground. Anyway, yeah, so I like that idea of that other space that's made up of like the neglected areas, like the bits that are like close to the world you inhabit, but that you never really go into. I want to say that the role-playing game Little Fears also had something like that. That was a game that kind of maybe fell between two stools. Like on the one hand, it was meant to be this game of like childhood terrors where there were boogeymen. I think the other dimension that all the monsters came from may have been called Closet Land or something like that, or just like The Closet. But then on the other hand, it tried to incorporate like very like serious and upsetting themes. And I don't necessarily know that it melded the two together very well. Well, you have to be very cautious when you do things like that, because you can sort of give the impression that what you're doing is a kind of using serious issues in the service of kind of sensationalism. Perhaps it would be best to say that it was very of its time. A later edition came out, and I have not read it, so who knows if it solved that problem or not, but it did have that idea of a space that I believe only kids could access, you know, by going into these kind of, like, abandoned places. And that's sort of, you know, not only under the bed or in the closet, but also, like, the way children colonize places that adults don't want. So I do like that idea that sort of, like, a network of underbed spaces and closets and attics and boiler rooms and, like, disused janitor closet at school and all, like, linking those together with some kind of extra dimensional space could make for a fun dungeon, particularly if you kind of had some good like three dimensionality to it. So if instead of just being like, oh, you enter a room through its door and then you enter another room through its door, but that there was kind of like a, you know, going up into the attics and down into the basements and so on, there could be something fun in there. Now, what would that dungeon be inhabited by? You know, what is the monster under the bed? It's typically not shown other than as like a pair of glowing eyes or a hand. And I think, you know, I think the last thing you want to do is give it like a hierarchy and a structure and ranks, right? It could either be a frightening sort of, you know, Freddy Krueger-like character that has a sort of dream logic to it, or it could be just like, you know, especially if you're dealing with like younger adventurers, that could be fun. It could be just a fight monster or something that has like a fear effect. A couple of undead creatures that sort of work like that, but I do like the idea that it's something where sort of the solution to defeating it is that you need to be brave. Like, find the things that make you brave. You can go and fight it, like, if you have your dog with you, or if you have your friends with you, or, you know, if you remember to believe in yourself, or whatever it is, right? Like, you want to avoid, like, didacticism in role-playing games focused at kids, at least I think you do. But then, I don't know, I don't have kids, so parents in the audience may feel differently. I do like the idea, however, that the things in a lost space are lost things. Maybe I only think that because I actually once, again, in an Unknown Armies game, there was this sort of other dimension, which is where all the things that have been forgotten go, right? The Big Rock Candy Mountain, it was called. That's where you go and find, like, telegraph weddings or, like, you know, the works of John Banvard. Or, you know, whatever, all these things that were once huge and have kind of just fallen out of society's awareness. The idea that there's this dimension populated by, like, lost socks and whatever it is that, like, when, because I think, maybe this is me personally, maybe this is my childhood experience, but I've always hated losing things. When I was a kid, losing Han Solo's blaster in the sandbox at my school, like, I wept. It was there and then it was gone. And I did not like that experience. But weirder, not as tragic, but weirder was when I was a kid, the first house we lived in when we moved to the U.S. had on the upper floor, I think what had once been a balcony and had then been kind of like screened in as a sort of, I don't know, sunroom or something like that. It was and it was the room where we would play, you know, where all the toys were and whatever. And, you know, they had laid down like new carpet on top of whatever, you know, whatever floor this place had previously had. And the result was that there was like a little gap between the floor and the wall. And I took one of my muscle figures. If you're not the same age as me, you may not remember these. They were a real fad for a short period in the early to mid-1980s, although I believe they're still out there. They were U.S. versions of a Japanese toy called Kinuku Man, and they were little rubber, like, kind of cartoony fantasy wrestling figures. They came in little plastic garbage cans, and for about 6 weeks, every kid in my school was obsessed with them. And I took one of those, and I just, like, with my thumb, shoved it down into the gap between the wall and the floor. And I was never able to get it back out again. For all I know, it's still there. The house is still there. Maybe someday when they decide to renovate that space, they'll find a little rubber wrestling man down the side of it. But that was very weird to me. The idea that it was still there, but that I couldn't get to it, couldn't access it, made me feel very strange. And that's the feeling that I think of when I think of this other world that the Under the Bed monsters come from. Now, does that make any sense? No. But the whole point about the emotions of children, I mean, nobody's emotions make sense, but the emotions of children make the least sense of all. And if you're going to do a Monster Under the Bed game, then that is the feeling that you want to recapture, right? It can't just be like, oh, little Jemima is frightened. Well, it's because there is a tentacle monster under her bed, and we fought it with swords and magic missiles, and now it's dead, and she'll be fine. That breaks the combination of the familiar and the uncanny that the monster under the bed should have, because the whole point about the thing is that it's nothing, but it fills children with a profound sense of the uncanny. So there you go. All you have to do is fill someone with a profound sense of the uncanny. Child's play. So I don't know if that's a helpful approach to incorporating the monster under the bed, but I hope that I have shown that there are ways to do it. I think there might be something in that dungeon, which is a series of interconnected spaces in people's homes, kind of a la Monsters, Inc., right? Where they have the doors that can go into anybody's closet. And the players, I guess, would be in the role of Boo coming through and going into the sort of monster side of things. Now, there, obviously, like, that's a certain kind of comedy, so it mundanifies the fantastic. I don't think you have to do that. Could be a genuinely weird and horrific experience. What if Boo went through the door, but, like, it was actual horrible monsters and not lovable John Goodman? I think there's probably something in that, you know. And I think that when we've come up with, like, one reasonably good scenario idea, which I'm sure somebody's done before, but, you know, don't spoil this for me. One reasonably good scenario idea, I think we can call a special episode a success. So, Jesse, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you've enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Jesse and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or if you prefer, you can pledge at other levels. That's okay too. In our next episode, we will be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition, and we'll be taking a look at old monsters given a bit of a new coat of paint, and hopefully some new ones as well. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.